Iran begins a 10-day celebration period to mark the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Israeli forces demolished the home of a Palestinian man in the occupied East Al-Quds, despite international outcry over such a practice. Reports emerging of Saudi security forces arresting prominent Shia cleric Sheikh Qadim al-Amri. His fate and whereabouts are unknown. Welcome. Iran is marking the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. The event is marked every year with a 10-day celebration period known as the 10-day dawn. Our correspondent Yusuf Jalali has been at this year's ceremonies and filed a report.
43 years ago this day, millions of Iranians flocked to Tehran's Mehrabad airport to welcome the late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, back to the country after 14 years of exile. The historic day was a milestone that put an end to centuries of monarchy in Iran. Ever since, Iranians have celebrated the occasion every year for 10 days. The event starts on the anniversary of Imam Khomeini's homecoming and culminates on the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. This period is called Dehe-i Fajr, or the 10-day dawn. As with every year, the ceremonies began with a visit by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, to Imam Khomeini's mausoleum. The mausoleum also hosted state officials and people from all walks of life to mark the occasion.
Like every year, we gather today in this holy place to pay respect to Imam Khomeini, a man who changed the course of history in our country and established a political system that respects our beliefs as Muslims.
Today is an important day for us. We, the new generation, were not present those days, but we participate in this ceremony to learn about the personality of Imam Khomeini.
The Islamic Revolution was led by Imam Khomeini, who spent some 14 years in exile in Iraq, Turkey, and France, from where he led a swelling grassroots movement, which ultimately led to the toppling of former Iranian monarch Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. The revolution was driven by anti-imperialist sentiments, since Mohammad Reza Pahlavi was believed to be heavily dependent on Western powers, especially the U.S.
During the Shah period, other countries like the U.S. made decisions for us. Iran was a U.S. colony. They were in our country to plunder our oil and other resources.
We lost many of our beloved ones for the sake of the Islamic Republic. By celebrating the event, we seek to say no to foreign interference in our country. We still stick to those ideals no matter how much pressure and sanctions the U.S. imposes on our nation.
Less than 2 months after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iranians took part in a referendum where more than 98% of eligible voters voted yes to the Islamic Republic as a new political system.
To Iranians, the 10-day dawn is reminiscent of their struggle for independence, a legacy that they're not willing to give up on, even if it means they have to endure U.S. sanctions. Now, one of the major goals of holding such massive celebrations is to pass on these messages to new generations. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
A prominent Iranian cleric, Ayatollah Lutfullah Safi Golpaygani, has passed away at the age of 103. Ayatollah Golpaygani died from a cardiac arrest after staying at a hospital in Qom for the past week. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has issued a message of condolence. Iraq's top Shia cleric, Ayatollah Sistani, has also expressed his condolences. Ayatollah Golpaygani was a member of Iran's Assembly of Experts, a body tasked with appointing the Islamic Revolution's leader. He was also a member of the Constitutional Council that vets candidates for public office. Over his decades-long career, Ayatollah Golpaygani trained hundreds of researchers and wrote dozens of books. He was also a pillar in the field of Islamic jurisprudence, as well as a master in mysticism and practical ethics. Another day of Israeli atrocities in the occupied Al-Quds. The regime forces have destroyed the house of a Palestinian man whom they killed late last year. Troops entered the Shuafat refugee camp to destroy Fadi Abu Shakaitim's house. They also clashed with Palestinians there. The man was shot dead in November after he killed an Israeli soldier and injured three others near the Al-Aqsa Mosque. At a time, the resistance movement Hamas described the Shekinah's action as a natural response to Israeli crimes against Palestinians. Israel routinely destroys Palestinian homes, citing different pretexts, including attacks on its forces. Human rights groups condemn the Israeli policy as a collective punishment and a crime against humanity. Well, I talked to Ramallah correspondent Mona Kendall about the latest demolition of the Palestinian house, and she said the Palestinians believe that such acts of aggression will not undermine the resistance against the Tel Aviv regime's atrocities and illegal occupation.
The Israeli policy of destroying Palestinians' homes in the occupied territories continue and never stopped. The excuses are numerous. This time, Israeli forces raided Shafat refugee camp in Al-Quds and decided to destroy the house of a Palestinian martyr, Fadi Abu Shkhedim, who was killed by the Israelis, despite the fact of that he was killed by the Israeli forces. The troops destroyed his home. We have to mention that his home is in a third floor in a residential building. The Israeli military said before it's a deterrent policy, but on ground they were mistaken. Palestinians said that the destruction policy and the demolition policy that never come to an end had never forced the Palestinians to stop the resistance against the Israelis. On the contrary, we continue to see people are engaged in different forms of resistance. People every day take part in protests and demonstrations. They continue to fight the Israeli regime, calling for an end of the illegal Israeli occupation. And of course, at the end of the day, this policy did not succeed and will not succeed, according to the Palestinians.
Lebanese capital Beirut holds a ceremony honoring tens of athletes and sports teams who have thrown their matches in solidarity with Palestine. Our correspondent Mariam Saleh has more in her report.
In honor of tens of athletes and sporting clubs, the Global Campaign to Return to Palestine held the International Forum to honor anti-normalization athletes under the slogan Al-Quds Golden Medal in the Lebanese capital, Beirut.
We are honoring these champions from Iran and different Arab countries because they refused to play against an Israeli player because they don't recognize the so-called Israel. So they paid a heavy price for that. We look at them as heroes.
Fathi Nourin, an Algerian and world champion who pulled out of four different competitions after finding out he would compete with an Israeli competitor, was punished by the International Judo Federation, which withdrew his Olympics accreditation. But he tells Press TV that nothing is more significant than Palestine. The athletes who were honored through their matches in international and regional tournaments to protest the presence of Israeli players or teams. Two chess players also had their share of a gold medal. So did 14-year-old Mauritanian Mohammed Abdulrahman.
There was like three people that qualified from Africa and I qualified. And during that tournament, it was the last round I played against this Israeli guy. And I just didn't play since it's a common gesture and I stand with Palestine.
The Global Campaign to Return to Palestine stressed that they wanted to launch this initiative to show that these athletes who paid a price, whether being dismissed from international tournaments or deprived of important medals and valuable prizes, have won people's respect for their stance in defense of Palestine and the culture of resistance. These athletes said they decided to rescind an international competition and prize if it meant recognizing Israeli occupation and apartheid state. Yet little did they know that by so doing, they became champions for millions of hearts across the Arab and Muslim worlds. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
Now, reports coming out of Saudi Arabia suggest that security forces have arrested a senior Shia cleric. Local sources saying that Sheikh Qadim al-Amri has been taken to an unknown location. The reason for his detention is not known. Sheikh Amri is the most prominent Shia figure in the city of Medina. He runs a famous mosque in the holy city, where local Shia Muslims and foreign pilgrims gather for congregational prayers. He's the son of Sheikh Mohammed, the top Shiite authority in the kingdom, who passed away more than a decade ago. Saudi Arabia has ramped up crackdown on dissent. Last week, a court sentenced another Shia cleric, Sheikh Abdul Latif Al Nasser, to 8 years behind bars. We talked to political analyst Said Shahabi for his take on the arrest of a prominent Shia cleric by Saudi forces, and he believes that the West, the U.S. in particular, is paid by the Arab kingdom to turn a blind eye to his crimes.
The arrest of Sheikh Kadhim Al Amri from Medina is a serious blow to any saying or to any claim that the Saudis are going to reform themselves. It is unlikely that the Saudis will tolerate them at all, because this is their structure, this is how they are. They are, it is only us and no one else. And unfortunately, they have the money and they are influencing America, the West, to keep quiet, to be silent, to remain silent, even when they killed people like Khashoggi. This Sheikh Kadhim is, of course, an ordinary, normal cleric who would pray with the people, who would respond to their questions. But he did not present obvious and clear political demands. I think they do not want anyone to establish his foothold in the, among the people. They fear the emergence of people like Sheikh Nimr, who was martyred by the Saudis in 2016.
Now moving on, Washington is increasingly becoming open about its direct military involvement in the Saudi-led war on Yemen. The U.S. says it fired missiles aimed at intercepting a Yemeni retaliatory projectile targeting the UAE. The White House press secretary says that the U.S. military deployed Patriot interceptors during the attack. Jen Psaki says that the U.S. is working, quote, quite closely with the UAE. This is the second time that American troops have opened such fire. The Yemeni armed forces said on Monday that they targeted sensitive facilities in the Emirati capital Abu Dhabi with ballistic missiles. Major targets in Dubai were also hit with drones. The retaliatory Yemeni attacks came while the Israeli president was on his first visit since normalizing ties with the UAE. The U.S. and other Western countries have been widely criticized for arming and supporting Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and their allies engaged in a deadly war on Yemen since 2015. A supply convoy of the U.S.-led coalition forces has reportedly come under attack in southern Iraq again. According to reports, the explosion ripped through the convoy on a highway linking Dhigar and Muthanna governorates. According to a security source, the convoy was carrying logistical equipment for American forces. No report of casualties or possible damage. No claim of responsibility either. American troops, as well as their military and supply convoys, have been repeatedly targeted over the past months, and that amid growing anti-U.S. sentiment in the Arab country. Anger heightened following the U.S. assassination of a top Iranian general and a senior Iraqi commander near Baghdad in January 2020. Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban says that he wants to increase natural gas imports from Russia under a long-term bilateral contract.
Considering that Europe is facing an energy, or better to say, gas crisis right now, making the long-term contracts you mentioned is significant. We are grateful to sign them. And during this meeting, I would like to reach our goal and increase the supply volume.
Now, Orban was speaking in a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Moscow. Putin promised him that Budapest will be able to buy gas at lower price than the rest of Europe. Now, the meeting came as Europe is facing an energy crisis, with a stand-up between the West and Russia over Ukraine now threatening to make the crisis worse. Russia provides nearly half of Europe's natural gas, and some European leaders are worried that Moscow could tighten the flow if hostilities break out. The U.S. is working to secure additional gas shipments to Europe from other countries. It has raised the possibility of Qatar supplying Western European nations with natural gas. But Qatar on Tuesday said it cannot rescue Europe alone if Russia turns off gas supplies. Now, speaking of Russia, the country saying it will not retreat in the face of U.S. threats as Moscow and the West remain locked in their standoff over Ukraine. Russian embassy in Washington has responded to the recent U.S. sanctions threats. It says Moscow was not standing at attention and listening to those threats. The White House has said it's ready to impose sanctions on President Putin's inner circle if Russia invades Ukraine. The Russian embassy blames Washington for the ongoing tensions. The two countries' top diplomats are set to speak over the phone later today. The U.S. and its allies are accusing Russia of planning an imminent invasion of Ukraine. But Moscow says it has no plans to start a war. It's demanding binding guarantees that Ukraine won't join NATO. Now, Italy has tightened restrictions on people who are still not vaccinated against COVID, limiting their access to an array of public places and services. Starting from Tuesday, Italians will have to show proof of immunization or recovery from infection to enter public spaces. Those include banks, post offices, restaurants, and shopping malls. The restrictions were implemented after vaccination became mandatory for those over 50. Italy has the second highest COVID death toll in Europe, after Britain. Meantime, Denmark is the first European country that's set to completely lift most pandemic-related restrictions despite a surge in Omicron cases. Authorities there claim that COVID is no longer a socially critical disease due to the country's high vaccination rate. However, the capital Copenhagen has seen an average of 50,000 daily cases in recent weeks. A UN rights expert on Myanmar, Tom Andrews, says that the ruling junta has killed civilians and waged a campaign of terror since last year's coup. He accuses the military of committing war crimes and crimes against humanity. The UN special rapporteur says that he received many reports of mass killings, attacks on hospitals, and bombing and burning of villages in recent months. According to Andrews, the military is functioning as a criminal enterprise and committing murder, torture, abductions, and forced displacement. February 1st marks a year since the military seized control of Myanmar. Streets in some of the main cities were nearly deserted on Tuesday as anti-coup ralliers called for a silent strike. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
In the limelight.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump's promise to pardon supporters who attacked the U.S. Capitol on 6th of January 2021 was the stuff of dictators, Richard Nixon's White House counsel has warned. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian columnist Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled Trump Pardon Promise for Capitol Rioters, Stuff of Dictators, Nixon Aide. Former U.S. President Donald Trump's promise to pardon supporters who attacked the U.S. Capitol on 6th of January 2021 was the stuff of dictators, Richard Nixon's White House counsel has warned. Donald Trump made the promise at a rally in Conroe, Texas, on Saturday, 29th of January. "If I run and if I win," he said, referring to the 2024 presidential election, "we will treat those people from 6th of January fairly. We will treat them fairly, and if it requires pardons, we will give them pardons because they're being treated so unfairly." More than 700 people have been charged in connection with the Capitol attack, around which 7 people died, as Donald Trump's supporters tried to stop the certification of his election defeat in service of his lie that it was caused by electoral fraud. More than 100 police officers were hurt on that day. 11 members of the far-right Oath Keepers militia have been charged with seditious conspiracy. Donald Trump himself was impeached for inciting the riot. 10 House Republicans voted to impeach, but Trump was acquitted when only 7 Republican senators found him guilty. That left him free to run for office again. John Dean, 83, was White House counsel in the Nixon administration from 1970 to 1973, before being disbarred and detained as a result of the Watergate scandal, which led to Richard Nixon's resignation in 1974. John Dean responded to Donald Trump on Twitter, "This is beyond being a demagogue to the stuff of dictators," he wrote. "He is defying the rule of law. Failure to confront a tyrant only encourages bad behavior. If thinking Americans don't understand what Donald Trump is doing and what the criminal justice system must do, we're all in big trouble." Trump was generous with pardons in office. Recipients included Steve Bannon and Michael Flynn, both now targets of the House committee investigating the 6th of January riot and with Trump in its sights. On Sunday morning, the New Hampshire governor, Chris Sununu, widely seen as a relative moderate in Trump's Republican Party, was asked if pardons should be offered to Capitol rioters. "Of course not," he told CNN's State of the Union program. "Oh my goodness, no." Even Lindsey Graham, the South Carolina senator and dogged Trump ally, said the former president was wrong. "I don't want to send any signals that it was okay to defile the Capitol," he told CBS's Face the Nation. "I want to deter what people did on 6th of January and those who did it. I hope they go to jail and get the book thrown at them, because they deserve it." But a moderate Republican, Susan Collins of Maine, indicated the hold that Donald Trump has on the Republican Party. Appearing on ABC's This Week program, Senator Susan Collins said, "Donald Trump should not have made that pledge to do pardons. We should let the judicial process proceed." But Susan Collins, who voted to convict Trump over the Capitol attack, would not say that she would not support him if he ran for president again. "Well, certainly it's not likely, given the many other qualified candidates that we have that have expressed interest in running," she said, "so it's very unlikely." Donald Trump dominates polling concerning potential Republican nominees for the 2024 presidential race. Others deplored Trump's words in Texas. Richard Painter, a White House ethics counsel under George W. Bush, said the promise of pardons should, constitutionally speaking, stop Trump running again. "This alone is giving aid or comfort to an insurrection within the meaning of the 14th Amendment, Section 3, Richard Painter wrote. "Donald Trump is disqualified from public office," he wrote. Donald Trump also complained about investigations of his business and political affairs, which have landed him in legal jeopardy. On Sunday, Lindsey Graham, whose actions in support of Donald Trump are being investigated in Georgia, said he would cooperate if asked. "Yeah," he said, "give me a call." But he also complained about a supposed effort here to use the law, I think, inappropriately. "So I don't know what they're going to do in Fulton County, Georgia. I don't know what the 6th of January committee is going to do. I expect those who defiled the Capitol to be prosecuted. But there is a political movement using the law to try to knock Trump out of running. And I particularly don't like it or accept it." In Texas, Donald Trump urged his supporters to protest. "If these radical, vicious, racist prosecutors do anything wrong or illegal," he said, "I hope we're going to have in this country the biggest protest we have ever had in Washington, D.C., in New York, in Atlanta, and elsewhere, because our country and our elections are corrupt." "Prosecutors," he said, "were trying to put me in jail. These prosecutors are vicious, horrible people. They're racist and they're very sick. They're mentally sick. They're going after me without any protection of my rights by the Supreme Court or most other courts." Glenn Kirshner, a former federal prosecutor and now a legal analyst for NBC, said, "Donald Trump is not only encouraging his supporters to violence if he's arrested, he's also signaling that he'll pardon them, just as he'll pardon the 6th of January insurrectionists. Will this finally move prosecutors to hold him accountable for his crimes?"
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagian.
A'udhu billah min ash-shaytan al-la'in al-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen. Bari al-Khalaiq ajma'in. بعث الأنبياء والمرسلين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا وحبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا وشفيع ذنوبنا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المكرمين المنتجبين. Today, in these days, mark the anniversary of the victory of Islam after an era of darkness covering the entirety of the earth, the darkness of the rule of kufr and injustice, having authority and power, controlling all governments one way or another, more or less, throughout the globe. These days are the days that the light of the Ahlul Bayt, the light of the Imam of our time, started to shine on the earth again through the revolution of the Ahlul Bayt, the Islamic revolution, and establishing in one part of the world, starting in that part of the world, the Islamic government, the government of the 12th Imam Ajjalallah Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif. This day was the day that Imam Khomeini Rahmatullah Alayh was able to make it back to Iran after all the sacrifices made by so many believers that stood up for Islam, for Allah, and they sacrificed their lives, they sacrificed whatever they had to make this revolution, the establishment of the government of the Imam of our time, to be possible. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to, those souls are blessed, we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to help us be a little more similar to them and be able to, inshallah, move in that direction. I encourage all the brothers and sisters to find material on it. Some of us are people who experienced that time. They saw it firsthand, either there in that country, or if not there, outside of that country, through the media, through what they heard. And the news was so sudden, and the events were happening one after the other in such unexpected ways that the media did not get a chance in the initial days to change what happened and to present it in the wrong way. So there's a lot that was getting out and people were hearing. The misinformation started coming out a little later. They were all caught by surprise. Everyone was caught by surprise. And I've been watching some of the documentaries that have been made by the Islamic Republic, putting together the steps, the stances, the statements of Imam Khomeini, that great leader, that divine leader, that is clearly divine, that was clearly divine, that was clearly the representative of the 12th Imam. He could not have made those decisions by himself. No politician, all of those who were involved in politics their entire lives would not have been able to plan these steps. The measures he took and the certainty that he had that this will succeed, the certainty that he had that the Shah will leave, the certainty that he had that now is the time to return, the certainty that he had to establish a government while the government of the Shah was still suggesting that they're still there, and the army had not surrendered, the military had not surrendered. They were still with the Shah. He established a government. As soon as he entered the country, the first speech he gave, actual speech, there was a small and very short little talk upon entrance in the airport in Tehran. That's not really the speech of Imam Khomeini. It was just for a smaller crowd, just to the people that were there, and then they moved on. The major speech, the actual speech of Imam Khomeini upon entrance, was at the cemetery, at the graves of the largest killing of the Shah and the largest number of Shuhada that were of a couple of months back and a few days right before Imam Khomeini came. These were very large numbers, in the hundreds, that were sacrificed, that they gave their lives, that were Shuhada, and people still came. So Imam Khomeini went there first, and his speech was from there. The first, in his first speech, he said, "Man tu dahane in dolat mizanam." I will, literally, I will hit this government in its mouth, and "Man dolat ta'yin mikonam." I will appoint a government, and then he explains based on the Islamic responsibility that he has and the support that the people have given him. He will establish and appoint a government. This was while the government of Bakhtiar, which was appointed by the Shah, was still in place, although the Shah had left. These steps, taking them so quickly, so rapidly, being certain that they will be effective, while everyone else, including the revolutionaries, were all wondering, is this going to happen? Is this the right decision? Is this Everyone realized, because all of what Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi had said up to that point was right, those who were with him, those who were part of that struggle, those who were part of that revolution. And I'm speaking of the ulama and the revolutionaries that were over the course of those years, the 15 years that Imam Khomeini went through this struggle. They were with him, they were part of that. Everyone saw that Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh sees things differently, and his understanding is accurate. So when he said to do things, although they themselves didn't realize and they couldn't see that decision to be the right decision, but they all knew that they need to go with what Imam Khomeini says. So these are very important days. I hope that at some point the documentaries are translated, and those like myself who didn't experience, some of us experienced it within that country or outside of that country, many of us didn't, like myself. And we need to study that, we need to look back at it, we need to understand it and understand what's going on today.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahim Kareem Azim Alim Halim Hakim Mateen Ghafur Shakur Wadud Qayyum Ra'um صابر مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
A study finds that average Briton produces more carbon in 2 days than a Congolese person does in an entire year. We now present you an article written by Karen McVeigh. The piece is titled, West Accused of Climate Hypocrisy as Emissions Dwarf Those of Poor Countries. According to an analysis by the Center for Global Development, in the first 2 days of January, the average Briton was already responsible for more carbon dioxide emissions than someone from the Democratic Republic of Congo would produce in an entire year. The study, which highlights the vast energy inequality between rich and poor countries, found that each Briton produces 200 times the climate emissions of the average Congolese person, with people in the United States producing 585 times as much. It found by the end of January, the carbon emitted by someone living in the United Kingdom will surpass the annual emissions of citizens of 30 low and middle income countries. Ewan Ritchie, a policy analyst at the Center for Global Development, Europe, said his work was prompted by the climate hypocrisy of Western countries, including the United Kingdom and the United States, that have pledged to stop aid funding to fossil fuel projects in developing states. Ewan Ritchie said, at COP26, there was lots of hand-wringing by rich countries about the extent to which aid and other development finance should finance fossil fuels in poorer countries. The hypocrisy of this caught my attention. Ewan Ritchie noted, our analysis shows that in just a few days, the average person in the United Kingdom produces more climate emissions than people in many low-income countries do in an entire year. It would be a cruel irony if the countries that have least contributed to this problem won't be able to have access to energy infrastructure. Several countries, including some developing countries and finance institutions, have signed up to a pledge to end public support for international fossil fuel projects. The same countries will be able to continue to develop fossil fuels at home. The United States has at least 24 pending fossil fuel projects, representing more than 1.6 gigatons of potential greenhouse gas emissions, while the United Kingdom is licensing new oil and gas fields in the North Sea. The Center for Global Development research used World Bank data of per capita carbon emissions for each country spread out over a year to calculate the point at which a British or an American citizen's energy use surpassed that of someone living in low or middle income country. About 940 million people, mainly in sub-Saharan Africa, do not have access to electricity. African leaders, including President Muhammadu Buhari of Nigeria, who has committed Nigeria to net zero emissions by 2060, and Lazarus Chakwera, the President of Malawi, have spoken out about their country's need to transition to net zero emissions via natural gas. The Energy for Growth Hub, an international research network, estimates that if 48 countries in Africa, excluding South Africa and several North African nations, tripled their electricity consumption through use of natural gas, the resulting carbon emissions would be less than 1% of the global total. Vijaya Ramachandran, the Director of Energy and Development at the Breakthrough Institute in Berkeley, California, argues that blanket bans on fossil fuel projects in poor countries are colonial and will entrench poverty while doing little to reduce the world's carbon dioxide emissions. She said, it's very easy for rich countries to impose fossil fuel financing bans on poor countries while at the same time increasing their own consumption of fossil fuels. She added, it's rank hypocrisy and it's devastating for poor countries as they need a wide range of energy to fuel development. She noted, it's well known renewable energy is intermittent and needs to be backed up by other sources of energy. Telling African countries they just need solar power is completely hypocritical and colonial. Rose Mutiso, the Research Director of Energy for Growth Hub, said the Center for Global Development Research should be used to inform the debate over responsibility for the climate crisis. Rose Mutiso, who is a Kenyan, said, solving the climate crisis in the medium term is the responsibility of high-emitting countries, not only because they caused the problem in the first place, but logically, it's where high emissions are concentrated. She said, the video gaming industry in California is using more energy than entire African countries. There's this idea that in California we can't live without video games or air conditioning but we are worried about Africans moving up and consuming. It's really important for us as Africans to establish that our development is non-negotiable. All of those decades of exploitation and being left behind that is owed to us. Rose Matizo cited a 2019 study that estimated electricity demand from the gaming industry in California alone would grow from 5 terawatt hours in 2011 to as much as 11 terawatt hours by 2021, the same as Sri Lanka's entire electricity consumption. Meanwhile, electricity could be delivered to more than a billion people currently living without it within a decade by linking up small-scale projects into a giant environmentally friendly network. According to a new global commission, advances in micro-energy grids and renewable energy technologies could dramatically accelerate change and transform lives in rural areas of sub-Saharan Africa and also in South Asia. The Global Commission to End Energy Poverty met for the first time recently to set out plans to accelerate the United Nations Sustainable Development Goal to ensure access to affordable, reliable, and sustainable energy for all the peoples of the world by 2030. The Commission, established by the Massachusetts Institute of Technology Energy Initiative and the Rockefeller Foundation, plans to bring together leading investors, utilities and policymakers to tackle energy poverty. Under the initiative, the distributed networks would help connect homes, businesses and schools to small-scale solar power projects to deliver cheap, sustainable electricity that can help power local economic growth. The Commission includes government leaders, energy industry chief executives and representatives from major development organizations. Dr. Rajiv Shah, president of the Rockefeller Foundation and formerly of the U.S. Agency for International Development, said, "A whole new way of thinking about energy distribution was required." Dr. Rajiv Shah said, "We cannot end poverty without successfully ending energy poverty. For 140 years, we've had this mindset that energy access means building big power plants and connecting them to national grids, and that's how you provide electricity." Dr. Rajiv Shah noted, "Today, new technology frontiers, business models, and our knowledge of alternatives is so strong that this commission will be able to set out a new roadmap to end the energy access problem for 1 billion people across the globe." The Commission also plans to help set up new regulation in developing countries to accelerate the rollout of new energy systems and make the projects more attractive to international investors. Dr. Rajiv Shah explained, "If I want to start a small solar-powered mini-grid program in a rural part of an underserved country, I could be prevented from actually providing power without permission from the state-owned utility, which might own that business opportunity. That's one of the many policy roadblocks that is preventing distributed solutions from really being easy to invest in." Dr. Rajiv Shah will co-chair the commission alongside Dr. Ernest Moniz, a former U.S. Energy Secretary, and Dr. Akinwumi Adesina, the president of the African Development Bank. Dr. Ernest Moniz warned that existing plans to end global energy poverty by 2030 are not fast enough and should be more ambitious. He said, "20 years ago, energy access might have been defined by having a 20-watt light bulb. One doesn't want to denigrate that. The shift from having no light to some light is major, but our ambition is more than that. We want energy access that allows for credible family, community, and regional economic development. Frankly, we'd like it to allow for entrepreneurial activity as well." Dr. Moniz said that by relying on renewable energy, particularly solar power, alongside batteries, developing nations should be able to attract investment in clean energy and rule out the need for future investments in coal-fired power plants. He said adapting such methods could also halt the wood burning that has led to mass deforestation in some countries. Just listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. Remarks of the leader of the revolution about the 22nd of Bahman. The 22nd of Bahman is the day of the salvation of the Iranian nation and the day of the flourishing and victory of the greatest revolution of our history from the beginning of Islam to the present day. The period of our history is after Islam, and also in the sense that it is the day of flourishing the talents of our nation and taking advantage of the hardships and sufferings that this nation has endured during its great revolution and during the years of struggle and movement. We, the people of Iran, consider this revolution as our great Eid. Before this revolution, we were societies far from human will, far from Islam, under the domination of foreigners, under the domination of the arrogant. The material condition of our country and the spiritual condition of this nation were both bad. Our revolution began in the name of God and with the help and assistance of God for the victory of Islam and the elimination of oppression, and was achieved by enduring hardships for 15 years and more.
Allah, Allah, la ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah, Allah.
On the first day of the victory of this revolution, we all said, and all the nations believed, that this work will not end with the victory of the American people in our country. The work will not end on February 13th, but the work will start on this great and happy day. On the 22nd of Bahman, we set foot on the paths, that the end of this path is an Islamic and human society that is comfortable, full of blessings, and equal to the command of God and the divine laws. We will gradually get closer to it. The 22nd of Bahman is a real holiday for our nation. The 22nd of Bahman is for our nation as the Eid al-Fitr, in which the nation came out of a difficult period of fasting, a time when they had imposed deprivation of spiritual and material nourishment on our nation. The 22nd of Bahman is the ruling of Eid al-Adha. The 22nd of Bahman is the ruling of Eid al-Qadir. Because it was on that day that the blessings of the province, the completion of the blessings and the completion of the divine blessings, became practical for the Iranian nation and a foreign realization. The march on the 22nd of Bahman must be done with greatness. Be careful not to hold a march or rally, however small, before the 22nd of Bahman. Keep in mind to ban such marches. If a certain group wants to march in a certain place, it should be after the 22nd of Bahman. On the 22nd of Bahman, the whole country should suddenly explode and people should take to the streets.
I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost, you've guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh,
this is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.